I hope I won't be counted against my time if I take a moment to observe what a privilege it is, first of all, to have the opportunity to speak in a forum such as this for Rabbis Roth and Rabbi Rosenzweig. And I think it's safe to say, as the youngest member of the faculty represented here, to be speaking in the company of such people who I admire, it's quite an honor for me. So I'll get started now with that out of the way. On May 25th, 1921, the Danish steamer Friedrich VIII docked in New York City. It was carrying a small company of men, distinguished beards, satin captains, some of them dressed in bourgeois German suits, in addition to a normal company of travelers, tourists, and immigrants in steerage. To the casual observer, they were not dissimilar to other groups encountered in other tourist venues, primarily in Europe, such as the Bohemian spas of Karlsbad and Marienbad, and in fact, they may well have been encountered as a group in one of these places a few months before. Met on the quay with moderate fanfare, this group, headed by a quintet of rabbis and one well-known layman, signified an important moment in the history of religion and politics in North America. They were delegates of the World Organization of the Agudas Israel, and their arrival was a first for Jewish politics in North America. For the first time, Torah true Jews appeared in a decidedly unapologetic and unfamiliar modern form as a non-Zionist Orthodox political party seeking to mobilize financial and ideological support from American Jews. It was also a first for one prominent public figure in the delegation, publicist, political theorist, and organizer, Dr. Natan Birnbaum. Although not his first visit to the United States, Birnbaum's membership in the Aguda delegation was his first appearance in a new guise to a community familiar with him and his work in a previous life. When he came to America 13 years earlier, it was as a hero of secular Jewish nationalism, founding member of the Zionist movement, an advocate of a robust modern Jewish nationalist culture. Then he was lauded and advertised by a pseudonym, the bold essayist Matthias Acher. He shared a stage in Greenwich Village's Webster Hall with a group as diverse as Judah Magnus, Chaim Jodlowsky, Yiddish playwright Yaakov Gordon, and union leader Joseph Berendes, all united in their admiration for Birnbaum. And his visit culminated in a meeting in the White House with then-President Theodore Roosevelt. Now, clothed physically and metaphorically in religious garb, Birnbaum had exchanged his call for a Jewish folk united by a common language and culture and demand for national recognition for a new message, one which was probably even more radical to the American audience. Matthias Acher had become Nussan Birnbaum, der Baal Tshuva. Now he spoke of the need for a politicized Jewish identity based on fidelity to Torah, observance of mitzvot, and rejection of the temporal, or in his words, materialist trappings of Jewish nationalism, especially Zionism. As jarring as his company was to an American Jewish community whose ideas about religion were complex and fraught, it was Birnbaum that became a lightning rod for criticism in the American Jewish press for his personal transformation as much as for the idea of politicized orthodoxy. And as many important names in the robust Jewish public sphere of Yiddish and English newspapers weighed in, a revealing discourse evolved which questioned some of the most basic ideas about the intersection between religion and politics and American Jewish identity. In displaying his changed self in America, Birnbaum touched a nerve far more sensitive than he or his delegation realized. Still in many ways accustomed to religious belief and practice as a category of daily life, to use the Weberian distinction as a traditional mode, especially among newer immigrants in the Lower East Side, American Jews were abruptly faced for the first time with self-conscious and strident orthodoxy in a radical new form. Birnbaum, the Baal Tshuva, proved to be the perfect embodiment of the dissonance of this encounter. The reason for the delegation's arrival, that we were coming to America in the first place, as Rabbi Blau has sort of alluded to, was the same reason, was to be found an important shift in the relative power of European and American Jewish communities. Once peripheral, American Jewish community, which had become massive, increasingly affluent, and largely unaffected by the damage of the First World War, was increasingly central. The delegation itself was supported by organizers in both the home offices of the Aguda World Organization in Zurich and contacts in the United States. And the delegation included, aside from Birnbaum, Rabbis Meir Dan Plotsky, Yosef Leiv, Asher Lemel Spitzer, and Meir Hildesheimer. Although all were figures of some eminence, they were a middling group. None of them were part of the elite membership of the movement, the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. And the trip served a few purposes. Pragmatically, and most importantly, it was intended to spread awareness of the goals and activities of the Aguda, and through that, raise much-needed funding. Its members also hoped to repeat their remarkable organizational success over the movement's brief rise in Central and Eastern Europe. Within just a few years of being founded in Katowice, in Posen, in 1912, the Aguda had evolved into a full-fledged mass movement, thanks to effective organization during the First World War in the devastated traditional enclaves of East Central Europe. It received the support, as is well known, of major figures in the Hasidic and Yeshiva world, and through them, a significant proportion of East and Central European traditionalist population. For the Aguda, powerful and growing, yet struggling financially, America was the last untapped reserve of support and money still open to the organization. It seemed to be low-hanging fruit. But as they soon discovered, success in all of these tasks proved elusive. With each passing day and each new venue that the Aguda appeared, they were met with bewilderment, and even bewilderment by people who were sympathetic to their views, and bemusement and derision by those less sympathetic. The agenda that brings Dr. Birnbaum and his friends from the Aguda here is not something which we can sympathize, objected a typical editorial in the Yiddish press. It's clear that their purpose in coming here is not to spread unity, but discord. Despite an intensive schedule of speeches and events from parlor meetings with well-heeled members of the Upper West Side Orthodox establishment, to a gala evening at Cooper Union with a whole program that included a performance by Yosela Rosenblatt, the delegation had in the end little to show for its efforts. Although chances are the most important meetings took place behind closed doors, aside from laying basic groundwork for organizational cooperation between the Aguda in Zurich and in New York, the delegation saw nothing like their success on the Jewish street in East and Central Europe. Indeed, in the very heart of what should have been the most obvious location of support in Lower East Side, immigrant communities, Yiddish-speaking, more recently arrived, less integrated, the Aguda met with nothing short of failure. Although I've discovered recently that a small item in the Yiddish Presse, which was an Aguda-friendly organ in Central Europe, that apparently here at the Rabbi Yitzhak Elkman Spector Yeshiva, there was a Tzaya Aguda group established, I think, as a result of this delegation. So it worked here. The shortcomings of the Aguda strategy appeared early on. And they were in a large part because of its basic ignorance about the dynamics of the American traditional and Orthodox communities. As a minor imbroglio, an unforced public relations error precipitated by Birnbaum himself illustrates. Assuming that it represented only the only legitimate Orthodox engagement with politics in America, the delegation and its planners overlooked or intentionally ignored the fact that there was some apparatus of organization among Orthodox Jews in America, Mizrahi, of course. In fact, Mizrahi, as we've already heard, established around 1914, was one of the more successful among the smattering of American Zionist organizations in general. More importantly, in concert with the Agudas HaRabbonim, it had emerged as a successful amalgam of religion and Jewish politics, claiming a respectable membership throughout the United States and Canada. On the other side of the Atlantic, the Aguda was overtly and consistently critical, even hostile, to Mizrahi for reasons very important to the European context, right? As much as it was founded from its earliest years to offer an organized Torah true response to the totalizing claims Zionism made on Jewish identity, so much more so was its raison d'etre true when it came to the precise admixture of Zionism and Orthodoxy that Mizrahi represented. Indeed, several founders of the Aguda were defectors from Mizrahi, alienated from Zionism by the cultural program initiated with the 10th Congress in 1911. At the same time, as a party that purported to represent the unified opinion of Orthodox religious leadership, the Aguda could, by definition, tolerate no competition from any other Orthodox group. And as the European marketplace of Jewish political options began in earnest at the end of the First World War, and especially with the establishment of the Republic of Poland, the Aguda's position as a strident and pronounced opponent of any accommodation with Mizrahi became de rigueur. But the Aguda delegation discovered very quickly that America was not Poland. Where Poland, as a hothouse of specifically Jewish politics, of many stripes, was characterized especially by insularity and Jewish political separation, in America the situation was far different. For the majority of American Jews, regardless of their place in the political spectrum, engaging with non-Jewish political parties and issues was possible or even encouraged. Those groups that counted on a continued or expanded notion of Jewish separation and isolation, including Zionists of all stripes, had to compete not just with other Jewish political options, but with a larger, more viable organizations, ranging from international socialism on the left to mainstream American political parties in the center and right. As a result, ideological flexibility, limited political ecumenicalism that allowed space for multiple ideologies under a larger tent like Zionism, became necessary in ways difficult to understand from the Agudas perspective. Indeed, so prevalent in both Zionist and Orthodox organizational leadership was Mizrahi specifically that it enticed even those who in Europe would have been or actually were opposed to it, as is pretty well known. Yosef Salmon actually notes that even those self-same rabbis who had been opposed to Mizrahi in Europe took up different positions upon immigration. Right. Now, the Yehuda's failure to comprehend this reality was on display in an interview with Birnbaum that appeared in the May 25th edition of the conservative daily Togblatt. In response to a question regarding the relationship of the Agudah with Mizrahi, Birnbaum replied that, quote, Mizrahim are truly fine Jews, but the fact is that they're led by the Zionist movement and have become but a small faction in that organization, an organization quite opposed to Orthodoxy, and thus they cannot be considered truly an Orthodox organization. He was prodded to elaborate and was asked whether or not the Agudah shared the Mizrahi ideal of Jews dwelling in the land of Israel governed by Torah. Birnbaum replied with similar finality that even if they shared the ideal of Torah's primacy, quote, their program is unachievable because the Zionist organization dictates Mizrahi's direction. That this response provoked some objection from members of the American Orthodox community was evident a short time later when a letter appeared in the Togblatt's pages penned by Natan Birnbaum himself. He writes, I did not say that the Mizrahim allow themselves to be led by the Zionist organization, Birnbaum protested. He continued, in general, I didn't say that they have no right to call themselves a real Orthodox group, but I did say that the Zionist organization would eventually overwhelm the Mizrahi movement. Birnbaum offers no explanation for how the interview, which was reproduced in a question and answer format, could so misrepresent him, but the point to be taken from the exchange is that Birnbaum felt the issue was so important that he had to emphatically revise a printed edition of his statements. Although the discussions that led up to the letter have not been preserved in the archives that I've seen, it suggests an attempt at damage control by the Agudah delegation. Clearly, Birnbaum's critical assessment of Mizrahi and its religious credentials was not received well. In other media, in the early 1920s, of course, New York was in its heyday as a center of a robust Yiddish press. It was Natan Birnbaum himself, more than the Agudah's message, that attracted attention. This was actually new. He was not a rabbi. He was not regarded as a particularly learned layman. And in the past, in other Agudah delegations, Birnbaum had played a kind of silent role, supporting as a sort of PR representative. So perhaps putting him forward as a symbol of the intellectual vitality of Orthodoxy, and this corresponds to the themes of most of his lectures, which were detailed descriptions of his process of tshuva, right, was a strategy. This might have been a strategy, an attempt to reach an American community that the Agudah regarded somewhat simplistically as drifting away from religiosity. In the press, the coverage ran a gamut from bewildered curiosity to outright hostility. Some reports were little more than clumsy anti-Orthodox caricatures. Others, even if they were not free from basic discomfort and bias towards Orthodoxy, showed considerable nuance in their meditation on the basic place of religion and politics in American Jewry. One essay by well-known Yiddish literary critic Shmuel Niger, Frumkeit und Macht, Power, Religion and Power, records his musings after attending the Agudah Gala at Cooper Union. His conversational style conveys a sense of alienation from a new, harsher aspect of Orthodoxy that he perceives represented by the Agudah, in clear continuity with his Yiddishist secular cultural orientation. To him, religion had its functions, despite the assumption that he shared with many of his fellow Yiddishists that it was a relic doomed to extinction, but that was not what was on display that evening. To him, the arrival of a delegation of European-style rabbis was a chance for American Jews to be exposed to a fading aspect of Jewish folk life. I wanted to see what was left of Jewish tradition in this country, and what is, for Jews at least, a country without tradition. It's an interestingly bold assumption, considering, as we know, and as he knew very well, that a significant proportion of the people he lived around both spoke Yiddish and were unquestionably traditional. But as far as the evening was concerned, he was deeply disappointed. The crowd, a mixed group, but overall were Jews, the likes of which one doesn't often come across in America, in such a grand hall, real Jews with beard and payas, and long kapputas, along with almost every other Jewish type, who had come not just to hear a chazan in a choir, but the living word. But what they heard instead, Niger reports, was no more than a cold official mass meeting, an appeal for donations, which missed the mood of its audience entirely. The simple Jew, Niger writes, didn't come to hear platitudes, nor stories about the hardships of East European Jews, or asking for support for institutions over there. This they've heard 100 times, and in much stronger terms. He's come to this gathering to be inspired. He came to cling for a little while to the Gedolim of Israel who he loves and in whom he believes. Particularly disappointing was the cold rabbi speech style of Natan Birnbaum. That he had spoken with the passion and fire of a convert, if he'd come to us simple Jews with his own cheshbon and nefesh, they would have been with him. But he came just as a pedant, and our religious Jews don't need his instruction and don't need his Torah. He's one of Chekhov's doctors, nothing more. A second essay by cultural critic Avram Karolnik, Der Baltshuva, in contrast, was a biographical meditation on the content of Birnbaum's message. Taking stock of his intellectual and literary wanderings from early Zionists to Yiddishists and finally to Agudists, Karolnik tried to grasp the broader meaning of orthodoxy both in Birnbaum's life and in the wider American scene. To him, Birnbaum, the newest Musserzoger, displayed the tragic yet all too present tendency of many disconnected and alienated Jewish intellectuals to idealize and construct whole cloth, a chimera of the Jew. We Jews were never on time, Karolnik laments. We always arrive too early or too late. Now that the outside world has grown tired of rationalism and progress, turning instead to a romantic search for authenticity, its root in obscurantist religion, so have some Jews tardily grasped the foggy mirror of Jewish Renaissance. Interestingly, his use of the term Jewish Renaissance shows some perception of the connection between Birnbaum's orthodoxy and his earlier nationalism, but to Karolnik, it was distinctively negative, and both were rooted in what he regarded as a destructive romanticism. To Karolnik, this was the essence of Birnbaum's orthodoxy and of the insufferable condescension of the Aguda's delegation. I must beg your pardon, he writes, but it's difficult for me to write about Dr. Birnbaum. It doesn't matter to me how far he's gone in this conversion. I don't believe in his influence and have no fear at all that the whole Jewish people will grow beards and pay us. Yet this tone of nonchalance does not endure long in Karolnik's essay, which turns to a darker assessment. The Aguda and political orthodoxy was not itself a threat. He didn't believe it would be attractive enough to American Jews to take seriously. But it was dangerous in that it lacked the sophistication, the Aguda, to recognize the powerful forces with which it was flirting, nor the uses to which it was being put, he claimed, by the likes of Birnbaum. Karolnik's essay concludes on a note of confidence that the religion of reason model of Hermann Cohen, among others, would triumph as the dominant model in shaping the Jewish future in America. But his confidence is belied by the overwhelming insecurity and discomfort present in his tone, and not just with the Aguda and politicized orthodoxy. Rather, it is with the entire lineage that he sees represented in the site of Nussan Birnbaum, the former Acher adorned in orthodox garb. To him and to many other respondents to the delegation, the core idea of a totalized Jewish identity, be it sung to the tune of Hatikva or clothed in a kapot and shtroimel, was a real threat to the promise of inclusion and pluralism he believed was essential to American Jewish identity. A child of the Pale, turned doctor of philosophy from Vienna University, Karolnik was unable to apprehend that his own exclusionary view of authentic Judaism, as the provenance of Spinoza, Einstein, and Hermann Cohen, might eventually have to come to terms, happy or otherwise, with the challenge offered by the Aguda and religion writ large. These themes, puzzlement at the aim or meaning of the Aguda, anger at the presumption of the movement and its misplaced message, and insecurity about the place of such a movement, if any, on the American scene, characterized much of the reporting about the event. In the aftermath of the voyage, the claim made by a few observers that Birnbaum's identity was far too complex, for better or worse, to happily fit within the Aguda were borne out, as were the dim forecasts of the delegation's potential for success. For the organization, the kind of robust financial support that they'd hoped to garner in America would not be seen until after the Second World War. This, in turn, had a direct impact on Birnbaum's career within the Aguda. Told by Aguda organizer extraordinaire, Yaakov Rosenheim, that his future as a paid functionary of the movement depended on the support coming out of this trip, meager returns meant that his days as a professional Aguda activist were numbered. In the end, this was more than simply a matter of finances. Not long after the return of the delegation to Europe, Birnbaum himself became increasingly distanced from the Aguda's aims. He moved on soon after, and although he remained deeply religious, Birnbaum began to explore other means of marrying his faith with political and cultural engagement. As for the Jewish community of the United States, the discomfort displayed in its encounter with the Aguda and the Baal Tshuva proved to be well-founded, from friction with Mizrahi and its supporters, to its perceived lack of authenticity by the downtown Yiddish cultural elites. The delegation had misfired. As it would turn out, American Jews were not yet ready for the model of assertive and unapologetic orthodoxy, neither culturally nor politically, as was represented by the Aguda. But by now, needless to say, this same group, more importantly, the mode it represents in American Jewish community and American Jewish life, has become a very significant force in American Jewry. And it has not ceased in embodying the challenge that it and its spokesman, Nathan Birnbaum, posed for the first time in 1921 to the very basic questions of Jewish identity and politics in America as its ever more prosperous supporters enter their second century on the shore. Thank you.